I understand my favorite chair is being reupholstered or something. So we'll have to struggle on in this one today. Actually, Western civilization is indebted to the Greeks for many advantages and some very profound thinking. This does not mean that the whole Grecian world was ideal, or that all the Grecians were of the highest intellectual quality. No such a society has ever existed. But, in many ways, the Greeks gave us a foundation in learning, which has become the basis for practically all Western growth, education, social, and political development. First of all, the Grecians came to the conclusion that there were three basic departments of learning. The first of these departments was mathematics. The second was astronomy. And the third was music. Now, this seems like a strange mixture. It is not likely that one of our prominent physicists today will play the Stradivarius or anything of that nature. He probably has no interest in music. He might have. It's indifferent. But to these ancient people, beginning about 600 to 700 years B.C., these three were the foundations, the legs of the tripod of knowledge. They were very definitely called a tripodium, or the three things that must be known. Now, to begin with, the mathematics. The greatest of the mathematicians of antiquity were probably Pythagoras and Euclid. Both of these individuals recognized that mathematics existed on three levels, and that each of these levels was symbolical of some kind of a universal truth. In the Greek states, there were no mathematicians who did not believe in something besides mathematics. First of all, mathematics became the basis of the realization of the exactitudes of existence. Mathematics indicated that God geometrized. So the first branch of mathematics was tied to religion. It was the way in which the individual could prove for himself the immutability of the divine plan. He could learn in his own way and in his own time the magnificent exactitudes of life. And he could also theorize, at least, on the source of these exactitudes. Did a mathematical formula that extends from the known to the unknown derive itself from nothing? Was it something discovered by individuals long before they knew their own existence? Or was it inherited from a savage world which did not possess it? How did we get this understanding of the exactitudes of life? Pythagoras gave the clue to the matter with his famous 47th proposition, which is attributed to Euclid, but was by Pythagoras. The answer to the whole thing was very simple. The highest level of mathematics was the spiritual realization of the infinite exactitude of the divine plan and the divine purpose. In other words, the first duty of mathematics was to sustain the concept of a spiritual universe. The Greeks had no way of interpreting it any differently. They could not believe in themselves that something that was absent or lacking could produce out of itself more than itself. Therefore, the total mystery of mathematics was the discovery of these exactitudes by mental thought, carefulness, and mathematical formulas. But the end of it was that the universe is an exact structure, not only all sufficient, but all ensouled. There has to be a divine mathematician, or the material mathematical sciences could not develop. So this was the first level of mathematics. The second level of mathematics went into other considerations. the exactitudes of the universe were reflected down into the exactitudes of the human faculties. The second level of mathematics, therefore, was the arithmetic of the human mind. The mind working in exactitudes. The world knowing, a kind of realization in which the mind inclined itself inevitably toward truth. The mind had the skill, the internal resolution, and the basic root necessary to recognize the divine plan. The mind, therefore, placed itself also in the position of being the interpreter of a universal reality, bridging the interval between the universe itself and the human brain. This was the bridge. The human mind was the bridge between divine mind and mortal mind. It became a key to the possibility of every living thing becoming in the course of infinite time wise and good. Therefore, the mind took the infinite plan and turned it into a code for the individual, giving him the assurance, the support, the conviction, the dedication necessary to apply universal mathematics to his own existence. Now, the third level of mathematics was barter and exchange. Mathematics was necessary in order that we might have time, that we might have seasons, that we might have the adding up of the ordinary grocery bill. It placed a pattern of exactitudes upon the inferior processes of life. It helped us to have a multiplication table. It helped us to add up our bills, to provide our proper bank accounts. It also gave us the possibility of all forms of personal practices within the scope of mathematics. It gave us the ability to plan the future. It gave us the sense of our own passing years. It gave us the seasons by which we are able to sow and to reap the harvests of the earth. So this lower level of mathematics might be considered the practical use of it, the use of it to attain ends consistent with the supreme mathematics upon which it was dependent. Therefore, the practice of daily mathematics must have meaning in terms of divine mathematics. It must be only an evidence to further support the power of infinite number and the infinite tables of mathematical procedure. So mathematics became a package in itself. It brought together so many different factors, but its primary purpose was a cultivation of virtue. It was there to prove that the individual could prove to his own satisfaction that the world in which he lives is an orderly structure, that he is part of something going somewhere and achieving something, that there are no accidents or incidents which are not covered by the grand scheme of number. He was therefore to become an idealistic mathematician, never for a moment assuming that he could accept mathematics without accepting God. It was necessary to recognize that these processes, which are still in scientific research, constantly being verified or experimented with in science, all of these have their basis and their foundation and their ultimate solution in the concepts of cosmic, spiritual, divine arithmetic. This was the theoretic arithmetic of Theon of Smyrna and Theon of Alexandria. Now, the second branch of our important structure is astronomy. Now, astronomy has a very different meaning in many ways. Astronomy to the Greeks was not primarily merely an observation of the heavenly bodies. It was not enough to examine the universe. We must find answers to the question, why? Why is the universe? What is its purpose? to look through a telescope and be satisfied to weigh the chemical elements of some distant star is a blind alley. It is meaningless. We must know why that star is there. We must know what part in the great universal plan of things all living creatures, living beings, and living substances within the cosmos have meaning, have significance, and have purpose. Therefore, astronomy is a way of proving scientifically, mathematically, and through observation by telescope and other devices that the orderly universe of the mathematician is true. That every way you turn in space, there are visible exactitudes of light, of color. There is everything you can possibly imagine, from the spectrum to the so-called dark holes. And all of these things are part of the anatomy of the body of the divine. Therefore, the purpose of astronomy is likewise twofold. The highest purpose of astronomy is to add the visual recognition that the universe is meaningful, that the wonders that we can think of in the mind can ultimately be seen in space, and that everywhere throughout the entire creation there is a magnificent plan, and that this plan is made visible through countless solar systems, through countless cosmic systems, and is broken down upon Newton's prism. Everything in the universe, therefore, is a series of dynamic exactitudes of the highest possible moral quality. The morality of the universe is also to be demonstrated in the astronomical seasons, in all the processes of this great space field in which all planets, suns, moons, asteroids and comets have their being. So the ancients naturally created also a astronomical theology. The Sabians of the Near East were star worshippers, so-called. The Indians, East Indians, also recognized the stars as supreme beings and came to the inevitable conclusion that everything that exists in nature, planetary or within the body of a cell, is in some way intelligent, and that this intelligence is not necessarily innate, but is bestowed upon it by something stronger and more powerful than itself. As the human mind is dependent upon the divine mind, so every little creature anywhere in space is dependent upon the great concept of creation. And creation, in turn, develops along patterns of eternal evolutionary growth and unfoldment. So to the ancients, God geometrized, and God also was seated on a throne above the firmament with the stars and the planets at his feet. This concept, therefore, was that we could develop another angle of our search for God through the study of astronomy, that we could gain confidence that the plan of things is real and adequate by observing the inevitable exactitudes in space. That these exactitudes could be accidental, it seems to be completely impossible. For no possible way in which a vast number of accidents can combine together to form an exact science. So this first part of astronomy, again, becomes theological. It becomes a way of reaching God, or reaching the God concept, and through scientific research, enlarging and perfecting this concept toward the ultimate recognition of truth. Now, the second part of astronomy has to do with the various ailments, processes, and so forth that have a direct bearing upon man. In other words, the human being lives in an astronomical field. And in this astronomical field, every part of nature is reflected in his own structure. Man is therefore a microcosm, a miniature universe existing within a greater one. Man is a miniature of all things that live. And by studying the internal, following the Egyptian rule, man, seek thyself, seek to know thyself, we get the key to almost all forms of universal knowledge. Among the early alchemists and mystical writers of Europe, it was stated time and time again that the human being was the symbol of the entire process of human regeneration and the final transmutation of imperfection into the fulfillment of its own needs. Also out of this, we come to the conclusion that the divine astronomy in man lays the rules for the man's life, how he is to live, how he is to think, how he is to develop the various resources that he has, teaches him to labor and to hope, teaches him to choose his profession from within himself, and using the ever-unfolding aptitudes with which he has been endowed. And gradually, man comes to realize that as the universe is beyond his comprehension, so his own potentials transcend his comprehension, and that within each living thing is locked a superiority which only careful thought and long and sincere effort can bring into its fulfillment. The third angle or part of astronomy becomes what we call today astrology. And the ancients were well aware of it. As the astronomy is the anatomy of the universe and the solar system, so the astrologer is seeking for the psychological structure of the universe to discover the moods and methods of universal behavior. It is to a measure, therefore, that the physiologist studies the body and the astrologer becomes the psychologist, analyzing the various processes and forces of life. The ancients and Greeks, of course, were informed on these matters, including Pythagoras, and later in North Africa, the work that is best known to us of Claudius Ptolemy. These pioneers sought to find a way by means of which the human being could profit consciously from the great examples around him in larger space, that he could learn in some way or other to use the energies that were released upon him from the universe for the advancement of his own kind, for the perfection of his society. He began to understand that every force in nature focusing upon the planet Earth is a force for its constructiveness, that it is there to help the Earth to grow. But if this helpfulness is perverted or destroyed by mankind, then the planet, which could become better, becomes worse. If the human being, therefore, becomes a dishonorable member of society, if in the garden of the Lord he becomes a bad gardener, if he permits things to develop and unfold which mathematics should have protected him against and which astronomy should have revealed to him the error of his ways, then he comes into a direful relationship, and these various rays that we refer to as astrological are simply the natural benevolent forces of life affecting a creature that has declared war against integrities, who is determined to have his own way in a universe in which there is only one way to go, that he is trying desperately to build his own empire in a world in which the perfect empire was built in the beginning. So that astrology becomes a searching for the principles and energies which can be used constructively, as in astrodiagnosis, in the detection of disease, as the study of planetary herbs and all that type of thing, and as many other phases, astrometeorology, the final method of calculating weather and climate. All these things are part of the philosophy based upon the concept, the basic concept of astronomy, which in turn is based upon the basic realization of mathematics. So we have these things working together very closely for the common good. Now, to this rather tight bundle of intellection, the ancients realized there had to be a release or an escape into another dimension of life. Science by itself is not enough. It can produce mentation, but mentation cannot save the human soul. It can help to develop the possibilities of life. It can contribute to our needs and our knowledge. But the individual cannot be perfect by becoming a perfect scientist. He must have other values. He must have other purposes. And the most important of all these purposes, probably, is to recognize the importance of the great emotional content which is locked within himself. This gives us the concept the ancients bestowed upon music. Music was a realization, recognition, and direct experience of harmony. That there is in the universe not a competitive structure, but a cooperative structure. That all the things by nature allowed to fulfill their own purposes will work together, live together, and harmonize in great patterns. Music, therefore, represents the music of the spheres in astronomy. It represents the marvelous tables developed by Pythagoras for universal harmonies. It shows the solar system to be a musical instrument, which was also discovered in China and India. Music becomes the refiner. It becomes the power to become strong and wise without becoming cruel and hard. It permits us to remember always the beauties of life, the kindliness of life. Music becomes the basis of harmony and is under the rulership of the divine principle of harmonia. All the good things that we know come from a measure of intellection and a measure of harmony. For instance, in science, or in astronomy, or in mathematics, what good is all this research if it doesn't make someone happier, make someone better, or help the world to have greater joy in existence? Ignorance is the source of sorrow. Wisdom is the source of intellectual light, and music is the source of emotional light and love. So to the ancients, music became the handmaiden of the principle of love, affection, and concord. It told us and tells us still the difference between concord and discord. It tells us what happens when we lose sight of the importance of the lawful pattern of music. The ancients, the Greeks, had their musical rhythms, their musical harmonies, their musical modes. These things protected the community. In those days in Greece, you could not build a building. You could not live a life without some type of contact with harmony. There had to be something more than strength and more than skill and more than knowledge. And that was a gentle humanity of inner respect and affection and regard. Now, as we face the world today, we realize that this particular factor also has been rudely disturbed. Most of the music that we now have that is so-called popular music would have been outlawed by the Greeks. Not because they didn't appreciate music, but because they had to study its effects. In other words, the therapeutic value and disadvantages of music must be estimated. And how do we estimate these things? We estimate them mentally by a realization which we call common sense. We recognize and estimate them mathematically in laws of cause and effect, in the larger pattern of things, that harmonic and enharmonic intervals and rhythms can be corrected by mathematics. Most always, also, we have the final consideration, and that is the physical aspect, the effect of harmony and inharmony upon daily living, the effect of hard, unpleasant discords upon the minds and hearts of people, that music perverted is as dangerous as any other perversion because it represents a vibratory factor upon which life lives or depends for its own maturity. A vibratory factor which shatters the nervous structure of the individual will not pass the intellectual examinations of the ancients. There has to be a realization that music also is a handmaiden of truth. It is the purpose of music not only just simply to make pleasant melodies, but to step over into other branches of life. Music becomes a very vital factor in architecture, and the great musical compositions are architectural structures. It becomes a great and important factor in art, in painting, in sculpturing, and in all the artistic expressions. If these are asymmetrical, if these are falsely developed, or if these are inspired by ulterior motives which are negative, the effect of these things when seen is destructive. It is not something in which you can simply say, let's forget it, because while we are surrounded with these enharmonies day and night and constantly live in the presence of them, there is no way of escaping their influence. We are now trying to curb certain addictions which threaten the survival of our people. And all developments in art which are non-constructive are also addictions. And very often they're simply a style media of one sort or another, an effort to prove that difference is divine. Difference is only divine if it is better. So we have the music coming in through painting, through architecture, through rhythms of all kinds, through the theater, the stage, through all art and entertainment, in which we also find the elements of romance or the elements of human experience. So all of this comes under the general heading of music. Now, music differs in different parts of the world, and we have sometimes amiss to know how to estimate the musics of other people. We have to recognize, of course, that other people have different vibratory rates from our own. We have developed a rate based almost entirely upon classical culture. Some other part of the world has something different. The Chinese moon lute has its strings set to the solar system and the orbits of the planets. The great monochordium of Pythagoras was actually a single thread uniting heaven and earth with the frets marking the orbits of all the planets. And these frets and these various divisions devised by Pythagoras are still regarded as valuable and elements in the structure of harmony. So we now have a concept of the three important factors that have to do with education, with knowledge, with the advancement of a civilization. And we realize there are three kinds of people: those who are trying to do better, those who are willing to stay the same, and those who are constantly falling below the level of their own previous achievement. These factors become, again, very important to us. Now, how did the ancients, the Greeks particularly, come to prepare their lives for this threefold recognition of the importance of certain sciences? It began, of course, as all ancient education did begin, in the family. The child in Greece, as a small child, was tutored by his own parents. And this tutoring was for both girls and boys. The Greeks were not a people who enslaved or ignobled their women. They were very definitely educated. And, of course, the greatest woman philosopher of all time, Hypatia of Alexandria, was of Greek origin. Actually, also, in the home, the individual was taught that he was part of a system. He was taught simply at first, but he had the support of all the neighbors, all the members of the community, and even the priesthoods and the higher cultures. He was taught to believe in the reality of a plan, that he was part of a structure, that he was born into this world with opportunities, and if he tried to break or escape these opportunities, they were suddenly turned into responsibilities and captured him anyway. It was very important, therefore, in the early life to become aware that he must be a mathematician, astronomer, and at the same time a musician. Every effort was made to drive these points home to him in the very beginning, to realize that there was no such a thing as a universe of physical matter separated from something higher. this world as a material structure was not a ship without a rudder wandering about on the sea of space. Every part of the universe was understandable, and it was the duty of the young person to develop as much of this understanding as he was capable of accepting. If you get a little further along in this, the Greeks used tutors to educate their young. These tutors were professional educators, and they were the ones that the philosophers usually looked down on and called sophists. Now, tutors are very dangerous things, and also we must realize that tutorship as such is a dangerous thing. Now, in our present way of life, these tutors are represented by traditional educational patterns. What we might term the grammar school would correspond with the tutors, with those who were supposed to advance the student to the point where he would be able to associate himself with some brilliant teacher. These tutors, therefore, were looked down upon by the philosophers. Why? Because they never grew. They never knew more. They clung completely to the old. They followed the traditional patterns, and even back in Greece, they were emphasizing the importance of becoming successful in the physical world. These tutors, therefore, were regarded as materialists. They were regarded as inadequate, but they were accepted for the teaching of the teenager as to the common problems of his language, his history, and the various relationships with society, the laws of Athens, the laws of Greater Greece, the countries that were friendly or enemy to the Athenians, and such matters. But they were the ones that sort of made an Athenian out of a Greek. Other communities made members of their own type. There were teachers that made Sparta's people Spartans. It was to adjust them to this culture in which they live. It gave them the foundation of the familiar and made it possible for them to drift through life without doing anything of great importance, and therefore, in this way, escaping the more painful interludes of those who try to think. After the tutors, the sophists, came, then there was the main problem. And that problem was the schools of scholarship. Most of the Greeks were educated under the direction of individuals. The school of Athens contained the great philosophical elect of its time. The school of study and understanding was broken into groups who gathered at various places, some in the Lyceum, some in the Academy. But all were teachers with a small group of disciples. This was very similar to the guru system in India. But these teachers were selected because of their outstanding ability, of the possibility through them of the young person receiving an extraordinary enlightenment. It was always the duty of these professional philosophers to make sure that the individual, if possible, could live his span without hurting himself desperately, without doing things he would regret for the rest of his life, or getting himself into involvements he could not escape. On a certain occasion, a man brought his son to one of these philosophers and said to the philosopher, "What is the advantage of allowing you to educate my son?" The philosopher was quiet any moment, and he said, "Well, if I educate your son, and he goes to the games, that is, these things like the Olympiads, and becomes a spectator of them, he will not be one stone sitting on another." In other words, when he sits down, he won't be just another rock on the chair. The man who was putting him there kind of thought for a moment, and thought that sounded reasonable, so he allowed the boy to go with this particular teacher. But the opener of the eyes was also known in Egypt. It was the person who began to give you the truth, began to relieve you from the adolescent delinquencies or restrictions of the sophists. It was the possibility that the disciple could remain for years with his master. and become fully informed as to the principles and teachings of the school for which he had associated his life. The Socratic school was one, the Aristotelian school was another, the Platonic Academy. These were all schools. Plato had intended to become a political figure in the life of Greece, but after a little experiment, he realized that the government was incapable of accepting a profound philosophical understanding of its own responsibilities. So he retired from politics forever, opened an academy where he had disciples, and created a little world of his own, teaching those who were ready to learn, and in the course of years, leaving behind him a message that has continued its vitality to the present day. Though, therefore, in these schools, various things were taught. And in order to get a real understanding of the Greek culture, it's really almost necessary to study the works of several of these different schools. Some of them were more or less at loggerheads. They didn't all agree on the same things. But most of them had some type of reconciling intelligence. They recognized that down on the level of particulars, you could fight to the end of time. But as you ascended from one level of learning to another, you came closer together. And in the recognition of the reality of truths, you became completely adjusted to all others of similar level. So all learning led to the state of learning. And always the learning itself was a solution to something. It had to give the individual a larger vision than he would otherwise have possessed. Actually, the schools, therefore, developed various levels, and many of the professors and teachers changed their own points of view as they went along. One of the most famous schools, of course, was the school of Socrates. In this school, Socrates was, in a sense, the mentor of Plato. He had a number of very close disciples and a very wise and remarkable person. He had his own peculiarities, however, and he was quite an individualist. Socrates would have been able to live out probably his full life if he had not objected to the idea that a good teacher could do more for a child than a bad parent. And this is what cost him his life. Plato said he would gladly pay the fine that was exacted for this break with the Athenians' policy. But Socrates refused to accept the payment of the fine because he said, if they want to work this sentence on me, I will not break the law of Athens by attempting to escape or to do anything else. So he died for his conviction. And his last words to his disciples were something to the effect that all his life he had studied, wondered, thought as to whether there was life after death or whether there was not. So he said, it's now good, I go to answer that question. If there is life after death, I shall live on. If there is no life after death, I shall cease. And whichever way it is, I accept it with complete acceptance and willingness. So this type of thinking was quite prevalent among the Greek thinkers, a thinking which was always based upon some deep conviction about reality. Another point in Greek philosophy that is interesting was the consistent low grading of wealth. The Greeks did not really believe in wealth. They regarded it as forever a testimony to what was wrong. Every individual who had more than he needed became less than he had been before. And in selfishness and effort to gain stature or to advance socially, the individual denied the real reason for his own existence. So, on one occasion, someone said to Plato, why is gold such a pale metal? And Plato replied, it is because it is frightened to death of the people who are going to own it. And this was more or less the vision of his time. The philosopher Aristippus, who was a rather iconoclast in his own right, was on a ship one day, and listening by accident, he heard that the crew of the ship was pirates, and that they were going to wait till night to take his belongings, his box of money that he had with him, and throw him overboard. So when the dawn rose the next day, Aristippus was sitting out on the bowsprit of the boat with his strong box in his lap, and he was dropping the money into the ocean, one coin at a time. And they cried out, "What are you doing?" He said, "It is better that this money perish for Aristippus than that Aristippus perish for this money." And this was the Greek point of view largely. Wherever wealth interfered with growth, they were against it. Wherever wealth became a blind alley, wherever the individual seeking luxury sacrificed integrity, this, the Greeks said, was wrong. And it became important to them that these things should be understood because of this relationship to the three basic forms of knowledge. If something permanently interfered with the quest for truth, this delay was dangerous to the perfection of the human soul. Therefore, to have enough is correct. On one occasion, Epicurus, who is, of course, regarded as the source of the word Epicurean, which generally now means a person who eats very specially excellent food. He is judge of food. Epicurus, it is said, once invited a number of his friends to a banquet. Of course, they all accepted with great joy. When they got there, there was on the table two or three loaves of stale bread and a couple of pitchers of sour milk. They all looked at him, astonishment. "Why is this banquet we were promised? Where is the feast?" "Well," he said, "if the truth were known, a piece of dry bread and a glass of sour milk is enough, and enough is as good as a feast." And they finally discovered it. But the idea that all these ancient peoples were living in luxury was not factually true. Most of those who I remember today were not luxurious. Many of them, like Socrates, had no house for many years and lived in a barrel in the Greek Lyceum. Later he had a little hut or cottage that was assigned to him. And one of his disciples said to him, "Master, you're all alone in this little house and you're very old. What will happen if you die? Who will bury you?" And Socrates said with a smile, Diogenes said with a smile, "The man who wants this house will bury me." There was a lot of wit in those days, and much of it has gotten into the permanent collections of human wisdom. They were not a heavy lot. The Greek philosophers did not believe in wandering about ponderously. They did not believe in long words that no one could understand. They did not believe in old texts that no one would read. To the philosophers, education was a living experience. The disciples gathered with the teacher by the roadside, and there they together studied life. And they studied it in the presence of the old trees and the little ponds and the flowers and the birds. They lived close to nature. And because they were close to nature, they did not believe in hate. They did not believe that the individual had to regard life as a terrible punishment for some kind of a sin that he did not even remember. We are not here to be punished. We are here to grow. Every form of life is here to grow. And those who know this grow joyously. Those who resent this and attempt to survive against the codes of life have misery. And wherever there is misery, philosophy says, here is a wonderful invitation to correct the cause. And to correct the cause means to stop doing the things that make us miserable and realize with the Grecians
that the gods intended humanity to be a happy, cheerful creation, worthy of the divine power that fashioned them, and that every individual who goes into some kind of a negative attitude is a disappointment to the gods. They expect better, and they therefore keep on prodding a little until they get what they want, and they will get it. Another Greek said on one occasion, I think it was Aesop, in fact, that the principal work of the gods is to cast down the great